You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
What we are seeing now is that the role in the second phase of the transformation is not as great as it was in the first role, because in the end, when it comes to organized political activities, when it comes to the elections, youth groups have not been as good at organizing, as capable to organize as some of the other other organizations. What we find is that in all organizations, in all political parties, in all political movements, youth play an important role, but not necessarily as youth groups. In other words, an organization like the April 6th movement in Egypt has certainly not been able to capitalize on the success it had in bringing people out in the streets, and turn that into long-term political influence. That said, I think there is no doubt that youth will continue to be a determinant factor in what happens in these countries, because their demands and their aspirations are going to drive the process of change. Now, there has been a big effort to document more, to learn more about what the youth want. And we are lucky to have here Rami Khoury, who participated in a project carried out together with UNICEF, a study of what Arab youth want, and Dalia Mohair, who has been studying for the Gallup organization, among other things, the youth organization and what youth want. So we have both at the big study, which is several months old by now, and more recent information. We have unfortunately lost the third speaker from UNICEF, who was also supposed to talk about the UNICEF study, and she had a family emergency, and she is not going to be able to be with us. Rami Khoury, who will be the first speaker, is well known to most of us, or I would think to probably to all of us. He's a well-known columnist, analyst. He is the director of the Issam Fares Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University in Beirut. He's a non-resident fellow at the Kennedy School at Harvard University, and actually he's a resident fellow right now, and at the Dubai School of Government. Dalia Mohair is a senior analyst and the executive director at the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. She co-authored with John Esposito a book, Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Want. And she was selected as an advisor by President Obama for the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. With that, I'll give the floor to Rami.
Thank you very much, Marina. Thank you all for coming out. I'm delighted to be back at the Carnegie Endowment and happy to be with Dalia and Marina here on the stage to talk about an issue of really central importance to the situation in the Arab world and to the future of the Arab world, I think. We, with UNICEF and 60 or 70 scholars around the Arab world and the whole world, scholars around the world who studied the Middle East, as well as resident scholars and indigenous native scholars in the region, we spent about 2 years studying the worldviews of young people across the Arab world. We spent 2 years doing workshops around the region, gathering all the information we could, tapping into the knowledge that UNICEF has at national level all over the region, and really trying to understand what were the issues that mattered to young people. And we said young people, basically we were talking about 15 to 29, even though we looked at early adolescence from 10 to 14, because that's a formative period in the age, in the lives of many young people. Many 12, 14-year-olds are working in the Arab world informally. So we looked at youth across the region to try to understand what is it that mattered to them. What are the issues that they were really concerned about? What were the grievances that they had? What were the constraints that they felt? What were the aspirations and rights that they felt they should have, and did they have them or not have them? We wanted to get a pretty comprehensive overall view of the many different perceptions and perspectives of youth across the region, knowing, of course, that it's not a monolithic, that there's all kinds of different views among all kinds of different people for different reasons. But we felt it was important to try to aggregate this for two reasons. One, to help drive a research agenda for the next few years for scholars around the region who are interested in the issue, but more importantly for policymakers in the Arab world, as well as foreign donors, foreign governments, UN, NGOs, all kinds of people all around the world, including some of you in this room, who are looking at young people in the Arab world and trying to do something to improve their lives or whatever. So we thought this was a good starting point. So we spent 2 years doing this with UNICEF as our partner and with many, many people all around the region. And we ended up with a study that was published a few months ago, and it's called The Generation on the Move, Insights into the Conditions, Aspirations, and Activism of Arab Youth. This is a summary, which is on the web. The full report is about 250 pages long, is just being doing the final editing is being done in Arabic and English. It'll be out on the web soon. But the summary captures really the key points that came out of our study. And I want to thank, first of all, UNICEF for being a partner and supporter, and the many other institutions around the region. We actually drew on much of the research that Gallup had done and had made available to us through a youth research consortium that we were all a part of, and their insights and knowledge was very useful. But first, I'll say, well, why we did this report? Why should we study youth? We didn't study youth because, as happens often in this part of the world, unfortunately, or in Europe, that youth need to be understood because they're a security problem, that if we don't understand youth, they're going to create problems for the Middle East and for the rest of the world, primarily in the form of terrorism, but also in the form of illegal immigration, drugs, sexual trade, crime, small arms trade, all the terrible things that people do when their world falls apart in some cases. And they do that here, they do it in Latin America, they do it in the Arab world, they do it everywhere. But we weren't interested in youth from that perspective. We were interested in youth because, first of all, we understood very well that youth were the best barometers that we have of what's going on in the Arab world. This may be true for any society, but it's certainly true for the Arab world. If you want to know what are the underlying issues that matter, go and talk to some young people, because they feel the pressures before anybody else does. So if it's unemployment, if it's violence, if it's sexual abuse, if it's political indignity, whatever it is, human rights abuses, young people feel those pressures more because they tend to be the most vulnerable. The second reason they're a good barometer is because young people tend to speak out more. They're fearless. They're not afraid of speaking out usually. Even in security state or police state societies, young people will often articulate grievances and complaints before other people do. So that's one important reason we felt that we needed to study youth to understand what was going on in society. The second reason is that we thought, and this was validated later with a lot of the research, especially the Gallup polling and other national polls, and is that the grievances that young people express in the Arab world almost perfectly match the grievances of adults. In other words, there is no such thing as Arab youth. There are young Arabs who express political and social and economic and gender and other grievances, and there are adult Arabs who express exactly the same grievances, with one or two exceptions that have to do with age and your position. in life. But on the key substantive issues of justice, of politics, of indignity, of marginalization, of oppression, of opportunity, of voice, of equity, of justice, of fairness, of all the fundamental key issues of people's lives as citizens, not as young people or as adults, but as citizens of these countries, young people's articulations matched almost perfectly the rest of society. So it was a beautiful window into what's going on in society. And finally, we're interested in young people because it was very obvious, at least to people in the Middle East who looked at the Middle East with any kind of realism, that if you have 120 million young people between the ages of 5 and 30, or whatever is the figure, it keeps changing, but you have 100, 150 million young people, these are the solution. These are energetic, mostly educated, mostly culturally well-anchored, religiously solid. They have faith. They have hope. One of the interesting things we found out of the polling data and other studies is that young people, despite all the pressures they had in the Middle East, they felt if they worked hard and they went to school that they were going to have a good life. There's this innate optimism that they had, a kind of a Islamic Protestant ethic, maybe we can call it. They had this innate sense that if you played hard, if you worked hard, played by the rules, went to school, and did well, you were going to have a good life. And we realized that if these societies, and remember we started this research in 2009, before the uprisings, that these young people needed to really to be seen as the solution to our problems in the Arab world. If anybody was going to educate and work and produce and create our way out of this problem we have in this stagnant Arab world, it was going to be these younger people. So for all these reasons, we needed to do a study of youth. And then the uprisings broke out in December 2010. And that was an extraordinary moment. Because it was the signal, and our study had just finished around that time. We were just ready to publish it in early 2011. The uprisings broke out, and of course, we didn't publish it. We held it, and we kept working on it to update it, and then we published it by the end of last year. It was ready to go. But what became clear was that all of the reasons of discontent and the grievances that we identified, and the positive hopes, and the solid cultural foundations, and the sense of integrity of community, the sense of commitment to family and country, all of the positive elements in young people's lives, as well as all of the grievances that they expressed, came together at one point, and on December 17, 2010, when after Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire, and then everything after that you all know, and that was the signal, we took it as a signal, that the young people had finally broken out of this acquiescent, docile mode of passive suffering. And they decided that they weren't going to put up with the problems that they were suffering. And they led this revolt. This was a youth-led popular revolt across the Arab world, in different countries, in different shapes, for different reasons. But it was youth-led, but it was a popular revolt. The expression was "Shab yurid isqati nizam," not "Shabab yurid isqati nizam." It was the people want the downfall of the regime, not the young people want the downfall of the regime. But this "Shab," the people wanting the downfall of the regimes, was a populist uprising that was in Tunisia and Egypt and other places that was initiated by young people, and then later everybody came out into the streets. So the transformations that have been triggered by these extraordinary youth-led but populist national revolts in many countries, which now have included Syria and Bahrain with ongoing fighting and tensions, and we'll see where all that goes, we realized that studying youth was also incredibly important because they're not going to acquiesce in their discontent and subjugation and mistreatment perpetually. And sure enough, they decided that if the system wasn't going to listen to them and improve their lives, they were going to change the system and improve the system. And this is exactly what seems to be happening. When we spent the first 9 months of our study consulting with people all over the region, we tried to identify the important issues. We didn't want this to be a typical study of the of young people in the Arab world, where you look at employment, health, education, this, that. We thought, let's identify the issues to cover based on what the young people themselves are saying and what scholars who study young people seriously were saying. And from that process, we came up with the table of contents or the issues to address, and we ended up with essentially nine issues that emerged. And they emerged naturally out of the consultation process. I'll just mention them. The report is available. I mean, the summary, you should get it and look through. But the issues that mattered were youth identities and values. And we use the plural because there's so many different identities and values. And how young people were able or were not able to express their identities and put their values into practice. The second chapter was youth civic and political participation. In fact, there was lack of political and civic participation and the inability of young people to do anything politically, given the security state mentality of the last two generations of Arab leaderships, meant that they had to go into other ways, other routes to try to find mechanisms of civic participation. And this was one of the exciting things that we started to document with many other scholars around the region, is what were young people actually doing up till 2010? They were doing community-level activism, volunteerism, religious societies, tribal societies, private sector-funded groups. There's all kinds of dynamism in society, young people going around the organized institutions of the state and the political system to create their own ways to get involved. There was a thirst to be involved in society and to improve it. The third one was Arab youth and media expression, and that's pretty self-evident, the many different ways that people express themselves in the formal media, which is not very much because it's controlled by the security state, but in the informal media, the internet, the digital media, the all the other things that young people had. And not just only media expression through formal digitized mechanisms, but social institutions, religious groups, tribal groups, community groups, school groups, professional groups. There's all kinds of groups in society that youth could use to communicate with other youth. The interesting thing about media, and this is a field that's being studied by thousands of people now, is that I think two things stand out. One is that young people, when they were not able to achieve in real life the goals and the activities that they thought they should be allowed to do, whatever they may be, cultural stuff, sports stuff, music, talking to people, reading books, whatever it is, normal activities, none of it insurrectionary or illegal or immoral, just normal activities that they were not allowed to do, either by their family or by their social constraints or by religious groups or by government or security services, or somebody was not allowing them to do what they wanted to do, they would find other ways to do it, and the internet was one place where they found other ways to do what they wanted to do in normal life. In other words, they created spaces for themselves outside of the constraints of society, and the internet was one mechanism. The other interesting thing was that almost everything that young people do on the internet, they also do in real life. In other words, the internet was not this place where people had a different personality, where they were personality A in real life and personality B on the internet, that they were the same people, but they were able to do on the internet digitally what they couldn't, or on their cell phones. They could do on the digitized world what they couldn't do in the real world. The issue of fourth chapter is youth autonomy in the family. The constraints on people in the young people in the family are really enormous. Now, this can be seen as a positive element: the stability of the family, the protection of the family, et cetera, et cetera. The family helps you when you need help. The family gets you a job, gets you hooked up in society, helps you with WASTA, helps you with opening doors. That's fair enough to say. But the constraints of the family were also very severe, and especially on on young girls, but even on young boys. And the ways that young people wanted to get away from the family constraints, even though they appreciated what the family gave them. And most young people talk of religion and the family as the two strongest parts of their identity. They value the family, but they also feel stifled by it, for the most part. There's always exceptions. So youth autonomy was an important issue, and especially for women. In chapter 5, we devoted a chapter to young women and girls, because this is an incredibly invisible population, young girls in the Arab world. They're just not there in public. They don't exist in the political sphere and in the public social sphere, but they exist in real life. And the young girls have even more constraints on them, and even fundamental issues that they would want to be involved with, like choosing a marriage partner, often is not their decision, or where to go to college, or whether to go to college, or to finish high school, when to get married. In some cases, these fundamental decisions are not theirs. So there's a chapter on young women and girls. There's a chapter on youth sexuality, which we knew would be controversial. It was difficult to do the research, but we did as much work as we could. And this is an important issue because youth sexuality is happening. Even though it's not talked about, it's not permitted, it's not accepted in most places, but it's happening. And this, we thought it was important to look at these issues and start to have a coherent, rational, positive, and constructive discussion of why is it happening and what can be done to prevent the worst consequences of youth sexuality run rampant. Chapter 7 is about migration in Arab youth, and there's massive migration of Arab youth within the Arab world and outside the Arab world, legal migration, illegal migration, and it needs to be understood for what it really is. It's a vote of no confidence by the most talented, the most productive, the most energetic, and the most hopeful people of the Arab world, which is educated young people. And some of the data from Gallup and other places was showing that an average of around 30-32% across the region want to migrate permanently. And in some countries, like Morocco and Tunisia, it gets up to 40 or 42%. It's an unbelievable figure of people who want to leave for good. So we thought that was worth looking at, and it's an issue that young people identified. The issue of Chapter 8 is youth in situations of violence and armed conflict, and this is unbelievably frightening. It's not just armed conflict and violence, and it's not just Arab-Israeli conflicts or Israeli colonization or American and British armies invading or Arabs invading each other, or civil wars within countries, or militias and criminal gangs within countries. It's this the whole gamut of all of these things happening together in the lives of young people, some of whom have only lived their whole life in a situation of conflict and tension and violence and oppression and fear and bombs. And it's incredible when you look at the documentation and the evidence of it. And then, of course, you look at the consequences, the psychological consequences. And finally, we realized that the issue of youth policies, this Chapter 9 needed to be looked at, because the problems that youth identified across the board were always problems that had solutions. They're man-made problems. None of these are acts of God or acts of nature. These are man-made problems. They're political incompetence and mediocrity, lack of serious political work and national coherence in these countries. And so we thought it was important to talk about youth policies to push that process a little bit forward. The result of all of these studies and consultations that we did and aggregating this knowledge was really a series of broad observations which I would make. And in retrospect, if you look back on this condition of young people before 2010, and we're talking broadly speaking in this report about the condition of young people in the decade before the uprisings, because the data we used was mostly for that last decade. We didn't go back much further than that. And if you look at that, you can see in retrospect so many reasons why these uprisings happened, at least at the level of young people who went out into the street, risked their lives, and still risk their lives today in Syria and Bahrain and Yemen and other places to come. They still risk their lives. And what is it that drives them to this almost desperate need to change their societies for the better? Well, I think in retrospect, we can see that a little bit in the findings of this report that we worked on with UNICEF and so many other people whose knowledge we tapped into. I would mention four. One is that, broadly speaking, young people insisted on having more space and freedom to be themselves. Not to be radicals, not to be antisocial, not to be violent challenger of society, just to be themselves. If they want to read a certain book, if they want to watch a TV show, if they want to wear something, if they want to talk to somebody, to have a normal human experience. And many, many young people felt they couldn't do that. There's too many constraints. Second one was to have the opportunity to achieve their full potential. And there was widespread sense among many youth of the constraints on them, that they just couldn't achieve their full potential. They couldn't pursue the things they wanted to pursue in life for various reasons, whether it was family control or political pressure or economic lack of opportunity or with many different reasons. Or they had to quit school and work just to get enough money to feed their brothers and sisters, as Mohamed Bouazizi did. To achieve their full potential and develop an active, productive, and stable, and decent life. And a third one, I think, is what to me is the single most important driving force of the activism of the last generation of Arabs, which I think is the core driver of these revolutions, is the question of social justice and equity. And social justice and equity can be translated into so many different things: clean water, access to healthcare, decent education, reasonably equal opportunities for employment, a justice system that treats everybody fairly, whatever realm of life you want to talk, holding political leaders accountable, lack of corruption. I would put all that under social justice and equity. And the grievances across the board, and this goes back, I remember doing a study in Jordan 20 years ago, the first study of Arab youth, and that was the main complaint by most young people of all walks of life in Jordan, the lack of equity, that some people had all the power and all the privilege and most people were marginalized. And then the fourth and last general point is that came out of this study, I would say, is the burning desire for young people to have a voice. They don't want to be invisible people. They don't want to be people who have no voice, who have no clout, whose role in society doesn't matter, whose feelings don't matter, who have no way to impact the political system, who have no way to hold power accountable. They don't want to do that anymore. Their whole life has been spent in this condition. And we're talking of a generation of young people now, it's important to remember, the first full generation to grow up in the modern Arab security state that came into power in the late 1970s. And these are people who have lived under nobody else other than Muammar Gaddafi, Bashar al-Assad, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, Ali Abdullah Saleh, Zain al-Abidin bin Ali. This is a generation that has known no other leaders except one leader, one family, one system, uninterrupted for a whole generation. And they didn't want to have another generation suffer these same problems. And this is why I believe this is one of the reasons why these uprisings erupted, is that these young people felt that they just, like Bouazizi, they had no voice. They didn't matter. They didn't count. They didn't exist. They were invisible people, and they didn't want to do that anymore. So those were the key points that I think came out of the work, and I'll just finish by saying that the important thing now, in retrospect, is to, I think this study is more valuable now than it was a year and a half ago when we first completed the first draft, and a year ago when we finished it. It's even more important now, because what this study tells us in retrospect is that if all of us, government officials, NGOs, academics, politicians, journalists, foreign donors, international think tanks, universities, pollsters, if all of us had paid more attention to the voices of young people in the last 20 years, the conditions of the Arab world may have been a lot better. And the fascinating thing and frightening thing is that on July 28 and 29 of 2012, just 3 months ago, they were rioting in the streets in Sidi Bouzid, in Hamad Bouazizi's town. They tried to burn the offices of Ennahda. They tried to burn the governor's office a year and a half after the uprising because they felt that they were not getting jobs or dignity or their rights. In other words, the fundamental conditions that sparked the revolt of young people and the entire Arab, not the entire, but large number of Arab people, those fundamental conditions have not changed in a significant way, other than in some of the mechanisms of public political contestation in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, where new mechanisms of governance are coming into being. But the underlying drivers, these grievances, if you talk to young girls, if you talk to young men, you talk to unemployed people, you talk to kids in school, you go to rural Morocco, you go to peri-urban belts in Jordan, you go to central Cairo, not much has changed in the lives of most people. And therefore, it's more important now than ever before to go back to these young people and understand what is it that they're worried about, what is it that bothers them, what is it that they feel needs to be done, and most importantly, what is it that they feel they can contribute to resolving these problems. So it's not just to look at young people as barometers and litmus tests of the broader problems in societies, but to see them as the critical dynamic element that can fix some of these problems. So let me stop there because I've talked more than I should and turn it over to Dalia. Thank you.
Go ahead. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here with Rami and Marina. Thank you all for taking time out of your schedules to discuss this very important topic with us. I'm going to base my remarks mostly on research that we've done at Gallup over the past several years. We've been studying Arab societies and Muslim societies more broadly since 2005. And what I'll do is look at some of the trends that we identified that propelled these revolts or uprisings, and then I'll talk to you, kind of picking up from where Rami left off, about what has changed since the revolts. How are people feeling today? What do they anticipate in their future? And how do these uprisings impact both populations that have experienced them, as well as those who are looking on from other countries? And then I'll end by discussing specifically findings on women and views of women since the revolution. So I'll really reiterate much of what Rami said about the main trends or the drivers that propelled these revolutions forward. But we really started, we looked at these empirically. One thing we found in our research that all societies that experienced major revolts shared was this very interesting disconnect, basically between what people expected and what they experienced. And we found that in a place like Egypt or Tunisia, over the past 6-7 years, GDP was growing at very healthy rates, 5-7% in some cases. I think a World Economic Forum report had Tunisia as the number one most, the country that rose the most on their stability index, and that was in 2010. And that was because it was based on what people bought and sold and not what they were thinking. Had they looked at popular sentiment in Tunisia, they would have seen a very different picture. Because as GDP was growing, people's actual well-being was plummeting. People felt worse about their lives today, and they felt less and less optimistic about what their lives would be into the future. And so you had this disconnect between with economic growth with no prosperity. You also had an interesting gap where people felt less and less free, and at the same time they felt less and less satisfied with sort of a paternal state. So the normal social contract used to be a populist economic model where people were generally taken care of, had social services, but not a lot of freedom. The dangerous thing was that people weren't getting either. They were less and less free and less satisfied with basic state functions like transportation, housing, education. All of these things were plummeting as people felt less and less free. And then third, and I think perhaps most importantly, it wasn't just economic factors that propelled the revolutions forward. And I think it's a dangerous and overly simplistic analysis to say that these uprisings were purely economic, because we also found a deep yearning for freedom, a deep yearning for democratic principles. From really the very beginning, when we started studying these societies in 2005, we found that people said what they admired most about the West were technology, and then number two, democratic principles, government that was accountable to the people, transparency. People were, in an open-ended question, producing these responses of their own, you know, of their own accord. It wasn't something that we were feeding to them. They were coming up with what they felt was the most admirable thing about Western societies, specifically in Egypt. Egyptians were the most likely majority Muslim society we studied to say that moving toward greater democracy would help Muslims progress. Over 80% had this view. But at the same time, Egyptians specifically were the least likely population in the world to actually practice any dimension of democracy as measured by simply asking people if they had expressed their opinion to a public official. Only 4% said that they had, and it was lower than people in Myanmar. So you had this very high level of democratic aspirations, and yet the lowest measured actual practice of democracy, and that disconnect created a driving force forward. So if these are the things that propelled these uprisings, what has changed since the world was mesmerized by the crowds in Tahrir Square and other places? Well, first, I'll start with the positive things. What has changed? People are more optimistic now. Despite 18, 20 months of a very turbulent transition period, remain optimistic, relatively, believing that the future will be brighter than today, that things will get better. People in societies where there's been a major uprising believe that the Arab uprisings will eventually bring about better economic situations, better governance, and even a more secure region. So they think that long term, these changes were positive and that they were worth it. They are going to impact them in a positive way. People are also generally more empowered. So we've looked at a question in different countries, specifically I'll look at Egypt, where we've done the most research over the transition period. And today you have more than 90% of the Egyptian public generally, and that includes youth, saying that if there's a problem in their community, it's up to them to fix it. The majority, over 70%, believe that not only do they have the responsibility to fix it, but now they even have the power to fix it, that they can make change in their community. The faith in the honesty of elections has risen dramatically across these societies, whereas before the revolts, before the uprising in Egypt, only 20-25% said that they believed in the honesty of elections. After the revolution, that number was closer to 90%. So there is a greater sense that there are channels through which people can be heard. Whereas you only had 4% who had expressed their opinion to a public official. There was this lack of all these complaints about the way things were going, but yet very little in terms of faith that any of the normal channels through which citizens normally express their grievances would work or were legitimate, because again, not a lack of belief in the honesty or legitimacy of the system. Now, where things have gotten much worse is, as Rami mentioned, the basic day-to-day economic situation has only worsened, and we see this very clearly in our research. A good time to find a job, percent of people who believe that is in the single digits, and it was really bad before the uprising, and it remains at least as bad, if not worse. People's views of the current economy have worsened, though again, ironically and perhaps hopefully, they do believe eventually things will get better. The security situation is one major issue. Pretty much across the board, people's views of their safety have worsened in every country where there's been an uprising. Now, interestingly, in most cases, with the exception of Tunisia, the actual crime rate, as measured by people's reporting on whether or not they have experienced theft or assault themselves, that has not changed. Or if it has changed, it's changed quite slightly, and really not a whole lot different from the rates of reported crime before the uprising. But fear of crime has skyrocketed in many of these societies. And so when you look at, you ask people their priorities for the government, the new government coming in, it reflects these issues. The number one priority is jobs, and it's usually even spoken about as jobs for youth. Then comes, general economic development, and then security and education. But despite all these problems, there is still this belief that ultimately these things will improve. And that, in some ways, creates both an opportunity and a huge threat. Because if these expectations are not met, or at least appear to be on track to be met, there may be another response, a different response than we saw in most cases, as generally peaceful uprisings, with, of course, some exceptions. People's expectations are very, very high, and that does present a volatile situation. And I think finally, I will, just close this one section by saying that another view that has risen over the past 2 years is the faith in peaceful means of change. So we've been tracking people's basically faith in whether or not oppressed people can make change to their situation through peaceful means alone. And the majority of people in the region have always said yes, that it is possible. But that number has gone up by sometimes as high as 20% over the past several months, and especially from before to after the uprisings, that people's faith in peaceful means alone has gone up. And that correlates very well with their faith in basic state institutions, like the honesty of elections, like confidence in the judicial system, confidence in the police. If that confidence starts to erode, if both governance and these expectations are not met, that view that peaceful means alone can work or will work also may be threatened. Now, how are non-revolting publics, if we want to call them that, how are they viewing the Arab uprisings? How is someone in Algeria or in Jordan or in Morocco or in Palestine or in Iraq viewing what's happening to their neighbors? Are they looking on in with envy or with anxiety? Well, generally, the answer is they're looking on with anxiety, not envy. And it's a very interesting, stark difference between countries that have experienced a revolt and ones that have not. When we ask about how do you view the future of these uprisings, will they bring about positive change or not? And basically, despite their momentary or current hardships, Tunisians, Egyptians, Yemenis, Libyans, strong majorities say that the Arab uprisings will bring about better governance, better economic situations, and even more security. But when you look at those countries I just mentioned that have not experienced a revolt, it's the exact opposite. Majorities either are unsure or believe that that these uprisings will ultimately bring about worse economic, worse security, and even worse governance, which I think was somewhat surprising. They don't even believe that these will turn out to be more democratic societies. Now, interestingly, the other thing that these two groups really differ on is who is responsible for the revolutions. So one welcomed, I think, casualty of the Arab revolts is the conspiracy theory that America is responsible for everything that happens in the Middle East, because you have majorities in Egypt and Tunisia and in Libya saying these Arab revolts were indigenous. They were not foreign sponsored or foreign created phenomena. Now, there are still pockets within these countries that still believe that they were something done to them from the outside, but the vast majority don't believe that. They think that it was about people wanting change from within. But that's not the case outside of those revolting countries. Outside of those countries, they're either, again, unsure or believe that these were foreign, that there was a foreign element to, that the foreign hand is still at play in these other countries, which I think present a very interesting growing disconnect. I think that over the next 5 to perhaps 10 years, we will see this divide between countries that have experienced an uprising and those who haven't. I think that they'll start to develop in very different ways. I think that's going to be a very interesting area of study, is how to view these. And so far, the result of these uprisings, I think, has been very messy. Maybe things will change if there's a successful example that others can look to. Now, I'll wrap up by discussing women and the views of women, how women are feeling about the revolts. The women, I think, have been a topic or a group that people have lately been quite concerned about, especially in light of the performance of Islamist political parties across the region. So first, we found that men and women were very similar in most of their views after these revolts. Men and women in Egypt are very similar in their views of their level of support for Islamist versus liberal parties. Women are no more likely or less likely to support Islamist parties versus liberal parties. They're just statistically identical, and that is the case in other parts of the region as well. Women and men are very similar in their views of the role of Sharia as a source of legislation. There isn't a huge gender divide. There's much more difference between countries than there is within a country. Tunisian women look very different from Libyan women, very different from Egyptian women, and so on. But they share the same views as men in their country. Their biggest priorities and concerns post-revolution, maybe not very surprising, have very little to do with quote-unquote women's issues. They're worried about the same things men are worried about. They're worried about economic problems. They're worried about security. The rising sense of fear is especially pronounced among women. Now, that's not unique to this region. We look at sense of fear across the world, and everywhere in the world, women are more likely to be afraid to walk alone at night than men. So that's not in and of itself a huge surprise. Now, views of women's rights. Now, we looked at that as well. Now, here's where men and women are different. Whereas they share views of the role of religion, the role of women, there's quite a bit, in some cases, a huge gender gap. Women, not surprisingly, are much more likely to support women's rights than men in some cases. Now, majorities across the region of both men and women say that men and women should have equal legal rights. Women should be able to work for in any job for which they are qualified. And in most cases, and there are other rights that we've looked at as well. But though majorities of men support these, in most cases with less enthusiasm than their female counterparts. And here's where women across the region are very similar. Here, Egyptian women, Tunisian women, Yemeni women look very similar, very, very high percentages in support. And then, interestingly, the men look very similar to each other across the region as well. Tunisian men are very similar to Egyptian men and so forth on this issue of women's rights. Now, do views of women's rights really matter? Why should we be concerned about this topic? And the reason is because we found an empirical link between how men view women's rights to work and to equal legal protection of the law and how likely it was for women on the ground in these countries to actually be in professional roles. So the more men, specifically men, support women's rights, the more likely they are, in fact, to be empowered on the ground. So then we wanted to know, well, what drives more progressive views of women's rights among men? We tested a number of variables, including men's views of the role of religion in society. And we found that there actually is no correlation. So men who support a very strong role for Sharia are no more likely or less likely than men who support a very a smaller role for Sharia to support or not support women's rights. And this was very interesting because, like I said, Tunisian men, Egyptian men, very different on the role of Sharia, totally agree on women's rights. There just isn't a correlation. It's not a variable that is linked to how men view women's rights. Now, what is linked to support for women's rights among men? Men's employment. The more likely men are to be employed themselves, the more likely they are to support women being employed as well. Higher education among men. Higher levels of well-being among men also are linked to more progressive views toward women's rights, as is a higher score for a country, men in the country a man is living in's UN Human Development Report Index. So What we found is that it was really human development rather than religion or the lack thereof that was linked positively to progressive views among men toward women's rights. And so finally, I'll end with what I see as, at least in the near term, the role of young people in these aspirational democracies. And Marina had mentioned their inability to really penetrate the political system. So a group like April 6th couldn't get themselves organized and capitalize on their ability to start a revolution. And I think that in the near term, because of so many factors, perhaps the best role for these young people is not to actually be in government as political actors, but rather be the conscience of politicians, to be the agitators, to be the ones holding people accountable. So in Egypt, I thought it was very interesting that young people within, it seemed hours, created a website called Morsi Meter. And what it is it literally just holds the president accountable for his promises. What is he doing every day? The young people, in order to, groups like April 6th, in order to give their endorsement of a political candidate for president, they had some conditions. And now President Morsi actually had to meet those conditions in order to get what he felt was the revolution's approval. Now, that's a lot of that's a lot more influence than perhaps they may have gotten had they just been someone else running for office, say in parliament. And I think that we might just open ourselves to the possibility that they could best serve democracy by creating an ecosystem for democracy in the near term, rather than participating directly in it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, both of you. I'll open it in a second, but I just want to make a comment both on this last point on the youth role and link it to what Rami was saying at the beginning when you said the aspiration of the youth are the same as the rest of the society. And in fact, after listening to you, I was rethinking my observation about the fact that the youth has not been able to capitalize on their initial impact. But in fact, what struck me, particularly during the last few trips I have taken, is the fact that you see them in other organizations much more. In other words, that you are I'm beginning to think, particularly with the newest groups, that the youth are playing a disproportionately important role within these organizations. Let me give you an example. I was shocked, in a sense, because I really did not expect it. Maybe I should have expected to discover that a lot of the organizers in a Noor party are extremely young. You know, partly because we all fall under the prejudice, we see the pictures of the old sheikhs with the beards and so on. And what you find instead, it's a lot of very young people who are organizers. They have the beards, but they are very young. They are not the older guys. So that I'm wondering whether, in fact, part of it is they're providing the energy to a lot of these organizations. And maybe it's all for the best that these are not just youth groups, but that are mainstream organizations. I'm not sure that you see it quite as much in parties that are better established, like Muslim Brotherhood. I think there are hierarchies there that have been solidified over a long period of time. But certainly, they are active in more ways, I think, than being the conscience of the revolution, although that is something that they tell you all the time. With that, I'll let me open it up to the... the gentleman back there, and then you and this lady here.
Daniele Moro, Johns Hopkins University. The question is for Dalia Mokai. Did you ask yourself why there is such a difference between the so-called Arab uprising or Arab Spring countries and the others? Why the others are not so positive. Because it's the first time that I hear, and it's really very interesting, this division.
Okay, let me take three. Yes, right in front of there.
Thanks. My name is Courtney Raj from Freedom House. I have a question about, you don't really talk much about perceptions towards the U.S. and foreign policy, but I would be interested in hearing whether you think there's been a shift in terms of how the U.S. is perceived, particularly in the countries that have not experienced uprisings versus those that have. You know, you talked a little bit about how some of the conspiracy theories about U.S. involvement have gone away, but you know, we also know that there's a continued debate over involvement in Syria and that sort of thing. So I'd be interested in that. And then also, nowhere in any of your surveys did the mention of Palestine come up. And I think that a lot of the young people first started getting active around issues related to the Palestinian Intifada in the early 2000s. So I wonder how much is that still an issue? Is that still something that national leaders are going to be able to use to divert attention from domestic situation?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Molly Williamson, American Academy for Diplomacy, and appreciation to Carnegie for making this important panel happen. Thank you. You all mentioned the essentiality of jobs. 50 million new jobs are going to be needed in this region for the next 10 years, over the next 10 years. How do people see their prospects over the next 20 months to getting these jobs? If there are skills gaps, as we have in the United States, then are there ways to close those skills gaps so that the jobs can come?
Okay, let's take these three and then we'll do another round. Go ahead. Either of you.
Let me answer the last two and then you answer all three. Okay. Let me just comment on that last two questions, and I'll leave Dahlia to comment on all of them. In reverse order, the jobs issue and the gaps of skills. My impression, having lived in the Middle East during the last 40 years and experienced these uprisings on the ground and followed them day to day almost around the region, there's a critical balance that we have now between material well-being and the intangible rights of dignity. Those two things, that balance between them is critical. What happened to spark the uprisings was that both the well-being and material needs of people were not met, and their political and social and rights and their sense of dignity was not met, and therefore it exploded. Now that there has been a change, and Dahlia's comments verify this with the governance improvement in some of the systems, people have a little more more confidence in elections and justice systems in some countries. There's a very sharp rise in the intangibles that are important to people's lives. So I sense, my guess, and this is purely a guess, is that this will build in an extra amount of tolerance for material deprivation for a short period of time. The other words, if there's no way the Arab world, given its present leadership, is even the democratizing countries can create all these jobs. We know that. People are going to have to figure out how to get through the next 5 to 10 years slowly improving, and people shifting from the informal economy to the formal economy. But what we also know from previous studies, and this came through the qualitative as well as the quantitative research we did, is that one reason these uprisings didn't break out seriously before, now they all broke, these uprisings broke out in many different forms in many different countries, but in small groups here and there, in lawyers' groups, human rights groups, women's groups, and in Iraq and in Kuwait, and we had many uprisings all over the Arab world, but never did they get enough momentum to do what they just did now. The reasons they didn't do that before is that there were countervailing forces of stability in people's lives, predominantly religion and community. And the people in Gallup surveys, for instance, who said they could rely on somebody, count on somebody to help them when they're in need, was like 70-80% in most cases. And their confidence in religious institutions, mostly Islamic, was like 85-90%. It was very high. So despite the deprivation that people felt, they also had mechanisms of support and succor in their own lives, at home, in their community. And that's, I think, that balance between the material and the intangible is a critical one for us to try to understand better. And so it's really the question is, what is the critical tipping point where somebody says, look, even if I have a fair justice system, I can't feed my kids. What am I going to do? Am I going to go out and revolt in the street? So understanding those balances is pretty critical to us. The issue of U.S. and Palestine, the uprisings, as we clearly saw, had nothing to do with foreign policy. And at the same time, the U.S. Anger against American foreign policies and support for the Palestinian just cause are very powerful in people's sentiments all across the region. There was a very important poll done last year by the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies, the group that Azmi Bashara heads in Qatar, which polled the whole Arab world, not the entire Arab world, but about 80% of the people were polled somehow. And that poll was very, very instructive, and it showed that Israel and the United States are seen as the two biggest threats to people's security in the Arab world, across the whole Arab world. So the U.S. and Palestinian-Israel issues are very powerful in people's minds, but I believe right now secondary to their more immediate concerns of getting their own house in order. But what we saw very clearly in Egypt, in the border incident with Sinai, with the embassy about 4 or 5 months ago, at the Israeli embassy, and recently with the reaction of small groups of demonstrators to the film, to the anti-Islamic film, they immediately targeted the British embassy, or the British, the slogans were about Britain, the United States, and Israel. And in Sudan, they went to the German embassy, which I still don't understand. I don't know if you can help me understand that.
Conveniently.
Not as well guarded as the American embassy.
Possibly. But, and then they attacked Colonel Sanders' chicken in northern Lebanon in Tripoli, which I can understand. I can understand that. But as an American Arab bicultural person who loves Colonel Sanders' chicken, that was something that I had to try to come to grips with, but that's secondary. So the American role in the region comes out, the anger against the American policies comes out very quickly, if it's given an opportunity. And if you look at the actions, you know, Morsi's first visit was to Saudi Arabia, China, and Iran. Well, Iran was for the non-alignment, but still, he went to China, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. And then he went to the United States, but only because he was going to the UN. And what did he do when he made his first interview in an American paper? He told the New York Times, the United States made commitments to Palestinian statehood. We keep our commitments in our agreement with Israel, Egypt said. You Americans have committed. So the issue is real in people's lives and sentiments, and therefore will come back when the time is right. But this is not a moment to address foreign policy issues, I think, in most people's minds. But that moment will come.
Yeah. Well, I'll start with the first question about the uprising versus non-uprising publics and why they are so different. And it's really, you know, just theories. I think that the short-term results of the uprisings are messy. They're not pretty. I mean, when you look at the news out of any of these countries, it's about crime being on the rise, and people who even live in those countries feel much more afraid than they did before. They are producing what looks like a great deal of chaos. And so people who are looking on and aren't experiencing any of the positives and really don't necessarily aren't really hearing or the narrative out of in the post-uprising Arab world is one of chaos right now, not one of better governance and stability. So I think that generally, this is the take-home message in many of these societies. And you know, interestingly, the country where there's the most negativity toward the uprisings is actually Jordan. So you know, in a place like Jordan, that's not what they're looking for at all. the one country where it's sort of in the middle is Iraq, where they have experienced, at least, you know, they have experienced their own regime change. Of course, it was slightly different. And some people do think it was worth it. You know, many people in Iraq do believe that they are still better off despite all of their hardships. So I think that that's my interpretation of what's happening. But I think it's interesting that this growing divide between these two groups will be something we need to keep monitoring. As far as perceptions of the U.S., we looked at this across the region, and basically views of the U.S. improved from 2008 to 2009 simply by electing President Obama. We got a little bit more of a bump after he gave that wonderful speech in Cairo. And then as time went on and promises were not followed through on in the views of people in the region, that those numbers came down slightly. Now, they are not what they were during the Bush administration. Obama still enjoys more positive views than President Bush, but his popularity has waned over the past 3 years. In Egypt specifically, where we were measuring month to month over the transition, the opinion of the United States has stayed surprisingly stable in terms of just simply approval rating. But what has suffered is perception of U.S. intentions. So we went from 65% of the people believing the U.S. was not sincere about democracy in their region to now it's over 80%. You had 56% right after the revolts opposing U.S. aid. Now that number is 83% opposing U.S. aid, actually not wanting economic aid from the United States, despite their incredible economic hardships. Now, what's really interesting, I think, is that when it comes to the peace treaty, Camp David, people are much more positive about it than they are about the aid that they're getting supposedly to buy their confidence in the peace treaty. So you have half of Egyptians saying the peace treaty is good for Egypt, and about half saying they're not sure. So it's like split down the middle, but overwhelmingly opposing U.S. economic aid. So it's just a totally different world, a totally different model. We need different levers and different tools to engage these publics into the future.
Okay. I'm just going to add again a small note on this issue of the intangibles and, you know, how Rami mentioned earlier the new revolt in Sidi Bouzid, for example. And that's very interesting because there is one intangible there that I think led to that, that we don't often think about. And it is that what you get in Sidi Bouzid now is a sense of entitlement, that they are the ones who sparked the whole thing and they deserve something they did not get. I mean, you get to Sidi Bouzid. I've been there twice since the uprising. And you get to Sidi Bouzid now, and there is a big sign at the entrance of the town that is, you know, sort of the motherland of the revolution. That's not the exact wording, but it's something along those lines. And I met with a group of young people in one of the community centers there, and all they were saying, the government has to build a big factory here that will employ all of us because we are the ones who sparked the revolution. And these are the intangibles, because there is no way that anybody is going to start a big factory in Sidi Bouzid, essentially, because, you know, it's not in the right location from anybody's point of view. But it's... there is a special situation in that place, for example, and this is what makes it so difficult to predict what might or might not happen. Let me take a second round. You have been very patient waiting before, and then the gentleman back there, and then there was...
Thank you very much. My name is Mehtab Karim, and I'm not an Arab. I work on Muslim countries all over. And I'd just like to go to some of the peripheral states, countries outside of the world, and Turkey and Pakistan are the two on which I've been working, along with some of the Arab countries. My questions are many, but one thing, Mr. Khoury, excellent work you have been doing, but you didn't mention anything about demography.
About?
Demography, the youth bulge. And that has been one of the reasons, which I'm a demographer, by the way, because in the 1980s, the population in most of the Muslim countries were growing very fast, on average 6 children per woman. And that's one of the reasons that there are too many young people in all these countries, about close to 30%, which if you look at Muslim world together. But so that's one thing which I was wondering, that why didn't you mention? Perhaps it's there in your 9 issues which you have mentioned. The second thing which really surprises me, that you say that there's very little intergenerational differences between elderly people and the young in terms of aspirations and what they think. And I was wondering what is happening to the generation gap, because today's young people have access to internet, television, much more than the my generation. So these are the two issues I would be interested in knowing why it's so. But the question remains regarding why it didn't happen, the uprising in some countries, and why it happened in others. Examples are Morocco and Algeria in North Africa against Libya and Egypt. Jordan and Lebanon, on the one hand, no uprising, but Yemen and Syria. And similarly, just look at, they need a spark, what I think. Just look at the recent video. In some countries, there was very tremendous sort of demonstration on the street, including Egypt. You had Indonesia, you had Pakistan. Turkey, nothing happened. In Algeria, nothing happened. Why it is so? Is there any reason? Because if you look at the level of education, economic disparity and everything, it's across the board in all these countries. Thank you very much.
Back there, the gentleman with the white shirt.
Sorry. I'm Q with Stimson. And so I lived in Jordan last year, and I have some friends who were part of March 24 Shabab, and also friends who were, Southern. And while they kind of disagree on what type of political reform should take place in their country, like, in general, they agreed that political change or being a part of the political system is what's going to help them affect the type of change that they want. But I guess my question is more pointed towards, where do you see the role of youth in other sectors? Like, when you're thinking about jobs or the issues with, getting the amount of jobs that are going to be needed in the region, there's a, mismatch in education and the type of jobs that are out there. There's, a lack of access to financial capital for entrepreneurs with these great ideas. And I know you spoke a little bit about youth being the conscious, or even with youth being political organizers, but what's the role of youth with these other issues? Because, I mean, I would say youth do see, from my experience, even, ones with divided ideologies about being a part of the political system or institutionalizing their efforts to affect real change. And this is something I would say is not just needed, in the political system, but also with, the public sector and the private sector, which is, associated, a lot of times with cronyism and, there's a lot of corruption. But still, these are issues that I think youth need to be brought to the table to, because it's their future. And I'm wondering if you could just speak about their role in these other sectors in addition to, already commenting on the political system.
Hello, my name is Jeff Levin. I'm a current student at SAIS. And both of you spoke about the differences between expectations and experience being a major cause or correlated factor with the uprising. So I'm curious as to what extent internet proliferation over the past 12 years has in some way or another either helped young people or the population as a whole realize the extent to which this inequality exists, both in our communities and the world, and also sort of make people aware that discontent is more widespread by increasing communication. So I was curious if there's any sort of findings through either of the studies about correlations regarding internet use, perhaps even within regions of countries where there were protests or anything. Thank you.
Okay.
You want to start this?
Yeah, you should.
Okay. Well, let me start with the question on why did it happen in some places and not others? And really, it's a very difficult question. I don't think that we know the answer. But one thing we did find is that the trend that we found with plummeting well-being as GDP grew, that actually was only in places where there was a revolt. In places like Algeria and Jordan specifically, well-being has not plummeted. It has stayed, it has basically remained stable over the past 5 years. People are not year after year feeling worse and worse about their lives. They may not be ecstatic or you know, feeling like everything's perfect, but the momentum is not downward. It's basically just stable, and that reflects, you know, the stability of these so far these countries. So I think it's not only about the state of these countries, but the momentum. What direction do people feel things are moving? And in Tunisia and in Egypt and even in Bahrain, year after year, we kept seeing huge drops in people's sense of how things were going in their daily lives. And I'll talk briefly about the internet and the role of the internet. First, I guess I'd like to balance the view that the internet was sort of the end-all be-all of the revolution. So we found in our research that those who went out to protest, what role did the internet have? In Egypt, internet penetration in people's homes is only 11%. Now, about 50% say that they have access to the internet somewhere in their community. But when you looked at people who, how did people access information about the revolts during the time when they were happening, most people actually got that information from state television. Number two was Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, and those were in the 60, 70, 80, 90% of the people. And only about 11% got information about the revolutions or about the protests from Twitter or Facebook. So that's not to say the internet didn't play a huge role. It's just to sort of balance out that view that it was the main factor. Now, it was certainly a factor in the spark and in the critical mass that was necessary to get things started. But the masses of people who went out to protest, the vast majority of them did not have a Facebook page, did not have an account, did not have access to the internet. This was truly a popular revolution, not one that was simply digital elites. But that said, I do think the internet did play a very important role in that spark that eventually brought it about. And here's why I say that. One prominent human rights activist from Egypt said that human rights activists had been documenting their government's violations for years and years for the international community, that was their main audience. They would document, they would write these reports, they would go to conferences and tell Americans and Germans and Swedes how horrible things were for people in Egypt, in hopes that it would somehow shame their government into reform. And that it was only when their activists on the ground changed their target audience to the actual population, and that was very much through internet activism. The most popular, of course, was Khaled Said's incident, and then that where all Khaled Said's Facebook page was the initial spark. It was when they started to document and show the violations to their own population that things truly changed. And so the internet played a very important role in getting a critical mass, not the majority by any means, but a critical mass of apolitical kind of regular people aware that there was something dreadfully wrong with the way things were going in the country. So I do want to kind of put those two views out there to balance the role of the internet being this massive tool. No, it wasn't, but it did play a very important role in how things sparked.
I would just add to that a couple of short points because we're running out of time. But, you know, the role of Paul Revere's horse in the American Revolution is probably the equivalent of the internet in our revolution. So it's a means of communication. So it's a critical means of communication. But it was Paul Revere's courage, not his horse, that's important to focus on. And I think we have to keep that in mind in terms of our, to not confuse the courage of human beings with the communication systems that they use. If Paul Revere didn't have a horse, he would have probably gone running, or he might have used smoke signals or mirrors or something. So, but there was that critical moment in the early stages in the Tunisian rural revolt around Sidi Bouzid, where Twitter was really important for the Tunisians to express themselves. And this is what some of the activists we talked to said, that it wasn't so much a mobilizing tool, because that was done more by state TV and Jazeera and others, and informal communications networks. I mean, Cairo, if you want to spread the word, you just go to about 10 mosques and the word gets out in 24 hours, or 15 grocery stores, and everybody gets the news. And but it was a means of expression. It allowed them to say things that they wanted to say that they couldn't say otherwise. The question about the role of youth in other areas other than and jobs. And one of the points that we are convinced about in our youth program that we're working on constantly at our institute at AUB with partners all around the region, now we're doing a lot more research. We have a program, a study now about youth and dignity to understand what dignity means. We started it with the Gallup Forum, that the Abu Dhabi Gallup Forum that was held last December. And we're now expanding it into a six-country study of youth and dignity. And all the research that we're doing, what we're starting to understand is that we really shouldn't use youth as a category of analysis. We should use the policy sectors as categories of analysis. In other words, it's not youth bridging the education and employment gap. It's employment policy that's a problem. There are incompetent employment policies in most of the Arab countries. Education policy is a problem. For youth and for adults and for literates and for everybody. So it's really, we should look at these bigger policy issues and the integration among them. One of the mistakes that people have made for years is to isolate one sector like women's rights or youth rights or environmental rights or judicial systems, to isolate one sector and try to work on it, especially foreign donors and UN and NGOs. And it's never worked. It hasn't worked. And I think youth is particularly clear that people I personally can remember 40 years ago in Jordan and Syria and Egypt, people talking about the mismatch between the education system and the labor market. Well, 40 years later, there has been no improvement in that mismatch. There has been complete, chronic, perpetual incompetence in addressing this issue, which we all have known about for two generations now. So I think we've got to get beyond these narrow sectoral views and look at these narrow youth-based views and look at the bigger sectors in the whole economy, in the whole country, whether it's water or agriculture, areas where there has been massive incompetence and regression in the Arab countries. The issue of demography and the generation gap, I mean, I didn't mention demography because it's so obvious that there's this large number of young, I mentioned the number at one point, I think, but it's just that it's the number of young people now has grown so big that the pressures on them have increased because of the numbers. And it's not the number of youth, it's the population growth has outpaced economic growth starting in the mid-1980s. And that's when you started to get all of these political tensions and all kinds of things started to happen in the region. The generation gap is interesting. There isn't a generation gap in grievance. There's a generation gap in response, I think. And this is, again, just my sort of journalist pop analysis. Dahlia will give you the more scientific answer. But there's a generation gap, and young people will go out there and speak their mind and suggest things, what to do, and tell you about what's wrong. Older people will be more hesitant to do that. And that's where I think you see the difference. Older people tend to be more conservative about going out into the street and doing something. Young people, not so much. But in terms of fundamental grievances, they're pretty similar. And that's why youth is a good lens to use to get a picture of the entire population.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm afraid we are out of time, and please help me thank you.